There we go.
Here we go. Now you can wonder as I wander back and forth in the front of the sanctuary. I know, I came up with that myself. So the prophet Isaiah lived at not a great time for the people of God. When they looked at the world around them, they saw a world sliding deeper into oppression and injustice. The Assyrian Empire was gobbling up all of the smaller, weaker peoples in the region, generally killing half of those people and dragging the rest off into slavery. And when the people of God looked within, they saw the same decline, the same downward slide. They couldn't trust their own kings and priests and leaders any more than they could trust outsiders. There was just as much corruption in the church as there was around the church. And the people were, they were casting about for a solution. Some fix, some way to plug the dike, to turn the tide. And they were mostly looking around. They thought, well, we'll imitate the peoples around us who are more successful. We'll copy their charismatic leaders. We'll use their power structures and systems. And God sends the prophet Isaiah to say, no, 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 no. I have a completely different way of doing things. And so for the season of Advent, these next four Sundays, as we live in what seems not a particularly great time for the people of God, where both without and within, we can measure the slide into injustice. We're going to look at four passages from the prophet Isaiah that are commonly called the servant songs. These passages all come from a section of the book of Isaiah's writings that's trying to give the people of God hope. It's trying to say it won't always be this way. God really is in charge. God really does have a plan, but it's not the plan you might expect. And so once at the beginning and twice in the middle and once at the end of this section, God speaks through Isaiah of his servant. And in this passage in Isaiah 42, particularly of his servant who will bring forth justice, who will make things the way they are meant to be. So, hear God's word through Isaiah from chapter 42, verses 1 to 9. Behold my servant, whom I uphold, my chosen in whom my soul delights. I have put my spirit upon him. He will bring forth justice to the nations. He will not cry aloud or lift up his voice or make it heard in the street. A bruised reed he will not break, and a faintly burning wick he will not quench. He will faithfully bring forth justice. He will not grow faint or be discouraged till he has established justice in the earth, and the coastlands wait for his law. Thus says God, the Lord, who created the heavens and stretched them out, who spread out the earth and what comes from it, who gives breath to the people in it and spirit to those who walk in it. I am the Lord. I have called you in righteousness. I will take you by the hand and keep you. I will give you as a covenant for the people, a light for the nations, to open the eyes that are blind, to bring out the prisoners from the dungeon, from the prison those who sit in darkness. I am the Lord, that is my name. My glory I give to no other, nor my praise to carved idols. Behold, the former things have come to pass, and new things I now declare. Before they spring forth, I tell you of them. The servant is who God sends to bring forth justice. And in this passage, God reveals through Isaiah how the servant will bring forth justice and what sort of justice the servant will bring forth and who the servant is. How and what and who. Nice, neat, three-point sermon outline. So how the servant will bring forth justice, first of all. And this is verses 2, 3, and 4. And the answer is the servant will bring forth justice quietly and gently and patiently. Again and again, this section refers to him bringing forth justice, and then it describes the way that he will bring this justice forth. So first, quietly, verse 2, he, the servant, will not cry aloud or lift up his voice or make it heard in the street. In Isaiah's time, most of the people of God lived in small towns or villages or in the farms immediately surrounding them. And so the way you communicated en masse, right, before microphones or newspapers or the internet, is you waited until the Sabbath day or sunset, sometime when all the people were gathered in the town, and then you shouted, "Hey, everybody, listen up. I got something to say." Right? And this would be a logical way to do anything that you hoped would change society. Right? You would try to get the people, society, on board. And the first thing that God says about his servant is he's not going to do that. The servant's way of bringing forth justice will not involve mass communication. There will be no grand announcement. There will be no campaign to make Israel great again. The servant will bring forth justice quietly. There's a comic strip called Coffee with Jesus, and the premise is eight or so, you know, sort of ordinary church folk who occasionally get to actually have coffee with Jesus. And mostly the comic strip is exposing how sort of unsaintly the saints are. Right? And so I enjoy it because other people's hypocrisy being exposed is usually funny. And there's one where one of the guys does something unusual. He asks Jesus a question Jesus wants to answer. So he goes, "Hey, Jesus, who's your favorite Christian singer?" And Jesus says, "Oh, let me tell you, there's this woman in rural Thailand who works 12 hours a day in the rice paddy, and the whole time that she's bent over in this back-breaking labor, she sings her heart out in praise to me." And the guy asking the question looks a little befuddled, and he says, "You know, I thought you were going to say, like, Hillsong." You know? And Jesus says, "I don't really listen to Christian radio." Right? The servant of God who actually brings forth justice does it quietly. He doesn't engage in trying to get the word out as loudly and as broadly as possible. He simply goes about his just business and doesn't call attention to himself. That's the servant's way of bringing forth justice. Now, that part of the how is easy for me to preach. I don't like publicity. One of my favorite sayings is that every time a Christian talks about their ministry's brand, an angel loses his wings. Right? So that, like, it's, I can get on board with this. But the next part, that the servant brings forth justice gently, this I have trouble with, right? Because this doesn't paint us in a flattering light at all. This is verse 3, which speaks of the gentleness of the servant. A bruised reed he will not break, and a faintly burning wick he will not quench. These images of a bruised reed and a faintly burning wick, they're meant to apply to us. If you count yourself among the people of God, then you are a bruised reed. then you are a faintly burning wick. And you know, the rational, reasonable, responsible thing to do with a bruised reed, a plant that will not bear fruit and has no hope of surviving in the long term, is to pull it up, to get it out of the way so that the nutrients and water in that soil can produce something better. That the rational, reasonable, responsible thing to do with a faintly burning wick is extinguish it and find a more reliable source of light. And yet the servant doesn't do that. He deliberately chooses to work with bruised reeds and faintly burning wicks. The servant deliberately seeks out not just the weak, right? Have you thought about the fact that an unbruised reed is no great thing? Or that a brightly burning wick is just burning itself out all the faster? That these things are weak even before they are wounded. And yet the servant chooses deliberately to bring forth justice through the weak and wounded. Which means your weakness and your woundedness are what qualify you in God's eyes to be a part of his bringing forth justice. The Spirit of God did not say to Paul, "My power is made perfect in spite of your weakness." The Spirit of God said to Paul, "My power is made perfect in your weakness, through your weakness," right? We are just so used to covering up our wounds and then avoiding our weaknesses, right? Maximize your strength, minimize your weaknesses, take some sort of personality profile and figure out what you're good at and just do that. But the servant brings forth justice through gentleness, through working with and through the weak and wounded. So maybe your weakness is anger. You cannot control your temper. I don't mean that you occasionally lose your temper. I mean years have proven that you can't control your anger. The servant looks at that and goes, "Great. Every time that you blow your top and expose your weakness will be an opportunity for you to point to my gentle mercy, to go to the same people in your life, your kids, your coworkers, your neighbors, again and again and again, and say, once more, I am sorry. There's no excuse for the way I spoke to you. All I can do is ask you to forgive me and trust that God in his gentle mercy will forgive me. As far as I can tell, my sort of besetting weakness is my ego. It's that I don't pay attention to my weaknesses and I just trust in my strengths. I assume in any situation I can help. I can be a part of the solution. This week, I'm going to meet with some people who I hurt by assuming I could help. I wounded them by forgetting that I am wounded and thinking I can fix this. And I don't know what I'm going to say. I don't have a plan or a solution, which is, as far as I can tell, is deliberate on God's part. If I'm willing to go in there and just be weak and wounded and say, "Look, I made this mess. I don't know how to clean it up. Here I am." Then maybe the grace of God will bring forth justice. Maybe. The servant brings forth justice quietly, and he brings it forth gently, working through bruised reeds and faintly burning wicks. And the servant of God brings forth justice patiently. quietly, gently, and patiently. Verse 4, he will not grow faint or be discouraged till he has established justice in the earth. That having to say that implies that in the course of trying to bring forth justice, there will be lots of opportunities to grow faint and many, many reasons to be discouraged. I made a new friend in the last couple of months. His name is Chris, and one of the things Chris is working on is making Corvallis a place where refugees who are admitted to the United States could come and get on their feet. Right? And that's an attempt to bring forth justice, right? The existence of refugees is a result of injustice in their homes, right? And the fact that there are millions, now tens of millions, of refugees living in refugee camps instead of in places like Corvallis is an injustice. So Chris is, he's trying to bring forth justice. And I got really excited about this because I've been praying for a while now. Like, we as a people need some communal, daunting work of justice. We need that both to be in alignment with the servant and for the sake of our own souls, right? And so I'm like, maybe this is it. So I started doing research. Best estimates, we are on our way in the next decade or two to there being 90 million refugees in the world. And you stack that up against the United States, the most powerful and prosperous nation on earth, going over the course of the last generation from a high of admitting 200,000 refugees a year in the 1980s, down to less than 50,000, right? Which works out to, if there are no new refugees, we can get everybody in sometime in the next 2,000 years. Right? And the optimistically years of foundation building and red tape cutting that would be required for Corvallis to start welcoming even a few refugees. Here is an opportunity to grow faint. Here are reasons to get discouraged. But the servant doesn't. His way of bringing forth justice is patient. The old translation for the word patient in the Bible is long-suffering. He willingly engages in long-suffering for the sake of bringing forth justice. So the way of the servant, the how of his bringing forth justice, is quiet and gentle and patient. Did you notice, though, that all of those ways are framed negatively? That God speaks in terms of what the servant won't do? He doesn't say the servant will be quiet. He says the servant won't cry aloud. He doesn't say the servant will be gentle. He says the servant will not break a bruised reed or extinguish a burning wick. He doesn't say the servant will be patient. He says the servant won't grow faint or discouraged. That's because he's setting up the contrast between the servant's way of doing justice and the way we want to do justice. We want to do justice, and anytime we manage to do it, we want to be loud about it. Look at what we have accomplished. Right? I would love in 5 or 10 years to be like, look, refugees here, settled, thriving. Aren't we amazing? That would make me feel so good, right? We want to do it aggressively. We want to get the most charismatic leaders, the most powerful institutions on our side to bring forth justice. And we want it to be quick, right? I want to be able to write a 5-year plan. Come up with a pithy vision statement and then just execute the thing. And here God says, actually, it's going to be the opposite. Bringing forth justice is going to be quiet, gentle, patient work. There's a prayer that I stole and have been praying over and over again and trying to get people to pray with me. So I'm gonna pause halfway through the sermon and ask you to join me in this prayer for upside down living. Lord, high and holy, meek and lowly, you have brought us to the valley of vision, where we live in the depths but see you in the heights. Hemmed in by mountains of injustice, we behold your glory. Let us learn by paradox that the way down is the way up, that to be low is to be high, that the broken heart is the healed heart, that the contrite spirit is the rejoicing spirit, that the repenting soul is the victorious soul, that to have nothing is to possess all, that to bear the cross is to wear the crown, that to give is to receive, that the valley is the place of vision. The story of human history is a King of the Hill story. Different groups scrabbling to be the, you guys know the children's game, King of the Hill? Right? Everybody tries to get to the top of the hill and claim it and throw everybody else down, right? Different groups trying to win the power struggle. And our normal way of trying to bring forth justice is be like, okay, let's win the power struggle, let's claim the top of the hill, and then we'll do it differently. We'll use our power for the sake of others. Right? To which the philosopher Pete Townshend says, meet the old boss, same as the new boss. We won't get fooled again. Right? And Jesus comes along and says, I'm going to do it completely differently. I'm not climbing some hill to claim a crown. I'm going to lay down my crown and quietly, gently, patiently stagger up the hill bearing a cross. My way of bringing forth justice is a different sort of revolution. That's the how. Okay. So the how of the servant bringing forth justice is quiet and gentle and patient, but what sort of justice are we talking here, right? Justice is a word that everybody likes to throw around and claim that they're on the side of. What kind of justice is this servant actually going to bring forth? Isaiah describes it in verse 7. To open the eyes that are blind, to bring out the prisoners from the dungeon, from the prison, those who sit in darkness. So the justice of the servant will open the eyes of the blind and it will set the prisoners free. That's the servant's sort of justice. Right, so first, opening the eyes of the blind. This is an idea, a prophecy that comes up occasionally in the Bible but doesn't get fulfilled at all until the time of Jesus. He's the first one to open a blind man's eyes. And I want to just briefly touch on one of the stories where Jesus opens the eyes of the blind. This is John chapter 9. As Jesus passed by, he saw a man blind from birth, and his disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Jesus answered, it was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. That story goes on for a while, and it actually is a story of unfolding injustice and justice that you can look at another time. But I want you to notice that Jesus, he's doing two things in healing this man's blindness. Right? The first and most obvious is there's a guy who's blind, which is a biological injustice. In a visually oriented world, it is not just for one person to be able to see and another person not to be able to see, right? And Jesus is correcting that injustice by opening the blind man's eyes, right? So that's the first thing that he's doing in terms of bringing forth justice. But the second is that he's opening the eyes of his disciples to really see the blind man. They asked Jesus a question, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Right? Smuggled into that is the assumption that this guy or his family make him less than us. We don't have to treat him as fully human, because his problems are his fault. And Jesus is opening his disciples' eyes. See, no. It's not that he sinned. It's not that his parents sinned. But it's that the works of God might be displayed in him. The best definition that I've ever heard of biblical justice is, justice is what happens in a society where everyone understands everyone else to be bearing the image of God. Where everyone sees God reflected in everyone else. And so you can't hold other people at arm's length for being blind, for being different, for being richer or poorer. You can't look down on people and say, your problems are your fault, therefore you're not my responsibility. When the servant brings forth justice by opening the eyes of the blind, he's not just correcting the biological injustice of blindness. He's correcting the societal injustice of some people looking down on others, some people being indifferent to the suffering of others. That's the kind of justice the servant brings forth when he opens the eyes of the blind. But that's not the only description of the servant's kind of justice. The second part of verse 7 says that the servant comes to set the prisoners free, to bring out the prisoners from the dungeon, from the prison, those who sit in darkness. Now, here we need to remember that Isaiah spoke in a different time at a different place. Dungeons were rare things in the 7th century BC. Pretty much you had to be a king and have a palace to have a dungeon. Which means the only way you got into a dungeon was by personally offending the king. By getting on the wrong side of the powers that be. About 100 years after Isaiah, there's another prophet named Jeremiah who so consistently offends the king of God's people that they chuck him in a well, because they don't even have a prison anywhere in Jerusalem. So this isn't like you stole from the gas station and you got 6 months kind of a thing. This is the king is mad at you. But kings were universally, even the less bad ones, instruments of injustice. They abused their power. And so when the servant comes to set the prisoners free, he's coming to go up against the powers that be, to cast down those who prop themselves up. The defining paradigm story of the whole Old Testament is God versus Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, this unjust ruler who has put in captivity and slavery all of God's people, and God says, no. They go free on my watch. And I will throw you down to make it happen. The sort of justice that the servant brings forth involves dismantling the pyramid schemes of the world. It doesn't involve winning the King of the Hill game. It involves tearing the hill to pieces. That's the kind of justice the servant is about, opposing every power structure from violent, oppressive despots, Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping, to the comfortably indifferent. The justice of the servant stands in opposition to the powers that be in an unjust world. That's the kind of justice that the servant brings. So he comes to bring this sort of justice, to oppose the injustice that exists in the world, to open the eyes of the blind in both senses, and he's going to do it quietly and gently and patiently. That's the what and the how, which leaves the who. Who is the servant? Come on, longtime people of Calvin, you know how every sermon ends. Who's the servant? Thank you. So, Isaiah drops clues as to who the servant is, right? And there's actually, the answer is a little bit more complicated than the Jesus answer, although it ends up there, okay? Who is the servant? The first thing that we can see in the text is that the servant is human. Okay? This is not just God acting as God, right? He says at the end of verse 1, I will put my spirit upon him, and he will bring forth justice to the nations. And then verse 5, thus says God the Lord, who created the heavens and stretched them out, who spread out the earth and what comes from it, who gives breath to the people and spirit to those who walk on it. See that? The servant is someone that God puts his spirit upon, and God is the one who puts his spirit on the people who walk on the earth. So the servant is one of us, a human being. Then, everything that we've been talking about so far, the servant is clearly someone moved to compassion for the weak and the wounded, the blind and the imprisoned. And then, the servant is, out of the peoples, uniquely close to God. Listen to all the first-person language in verse 1. Behold, my servant, whom I uphold, my chosen, in whom my soul delights. And then verse 6, God speaking to the servant, I am the Lord, I have called you in righteousness, I will take you by the hand and keep you. So the servant, this is a human servant who's got compassion for the weak and the wounded and has a particular, a special, an intimate relationship with the creator of the universe. And all of that could and should have described the people of God. I'm not going to take you on a tour of all of the Bible, but all of that language describes God's people again and again and again. We're human. We are meant to have a particular compassion for the weak and the wounded because we know ourselves to be weak and wounded. And we are meant to have a unique relationship with God. He calls us his treasured possession over and over again. It should have been us. Could have been us. Someday it will be us. But not yet. Not yet. Verse 6 again. I am the Lord. I have called you in righteousness. I will take you by the hand and keep you. I will give you as a covenant for the people, a light for the nations. A light for the nations that could have, that should have been Israel. That's language that gets applied to the people of God. But right before that, I will give you as a covenant for the people. The servant isn't the people. The servant is something God gives to the people, someone God gives to the people as a covenant. A covenant, short version, is a life and death agreement between two unequal parties. One party that has dramatically more power than the other, and this, the stakes of this agreement are life and death. And the covenants were always sealed by the shedding of blood. The Hebrew for making a covenant is karat barit, which actually means to cut a covenant. Something had to be cut just to symbolize the seriousness of it. And again and again and again, God has made covenants with his people. But now he steps it up. And he says of the servant, I'm not going to make a covenant between you and me or between you and the people. I'm going to give you as a covenant to the people. Meaning the servant is the one who's going to be cut. It will be his sacrifice that demonstrates the seriousness of this agreement. It's true. A bruised reed, the servant will not break. Because as the only truly healthy unbruised reed ever to exist, he will allow himself to be broken. It's true. Faintly burning wicks, the servant will not quench. Because as the light that has been burning brighter than we can imagine since before God said, "Let there be light," he allowed himself to be quenched for us. So that when he stepped out of the darkness of the tomb, he did so as a light for all the nations. Jesus is the servant. Jesus is the one who will bring forth a justice we have never seen but always longed for, and will bring it forth in a way we have never even dared to imagine but have always needed. And my friends, my fellow bruised reeds, my fellow sputtering and dying wicks, he will, in his gentle grace, bring us into that work. That's how God brings justice to a world crying out for it. We're going to respond to that good news in prayer. If you've got a Bible, you can turn over to Micah chapter 4, the passage that I read earlier. And this is Micah, actually, he and Isaiah were contemporaries. They might have known each other. Judah wasn't that big of a place. This is one of several places in the prophets that point us toward not just a world in which God will bring forth justice, but what the world will be like when God has brought forth justice. So I'm gonna read this again. I'm gonna go slowly, and I want your mind to wander. I'm sure it didn't wander at all while I was preaching, but now I want your mind to wander. Wander and dwell upon the distance between where we are as a world and where God promises we will be someday. And then I'll start us off in prayer, and I'm going to leave lots of space for any of you to pray either silently or aloud. In the vein that Jesus taught us to pray, look,